European News Bulletin.
From London, hello everyone. My name is Saeed Puriza. We'll begin this broadcast with the U.S. presidential elections right after this. The U.S. election might just have the highest turnout in a century, and the surge in postal ballots means the results might not be in for weeks. Nearly 100 million people cast their ballots in early voting, and another 50 million are expected to do so today. Bianca Rahimi has more.
President Donald Trump and Democratic vice presidential nominee Joe Biden spent the final hours of their presidential race rallying in key swing states. Biden in Pennsylvania.
Decency, honor, respect. Where has it gone with this president? Well, let me tell you something, folks. Tomorrow's the beginning of a new day. Tomorrow, we can put an end to a presidency that has left hardworking Americans out in the cold. Tomorrow, we can put an end to a presidency that has divided this nation and fanned the flames of hate.
And Trump in Michigan.
Biden has vowed to increase refugee admissions from terrorist nations by over 700%, including from Syria, Somalia, and Yemen. The Biden plan would overwhelm your communities and turn Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and the entire Midwest into a virtual refugee camp.
National polls give a firm lead to Biden, but it is a closer race in states such as these that could decide the outcome. And as in 2016, many people might be brought out to vote who are beyond the pollster's radar screen or off the grid. We've all witnessed Trump's presidential style. So what does Biden plan to do differently? Biden says he wants to restore America's standing on the world stage and cultivate stronger bonds with American allies, criticizing Trump's America First slogan, saying it often leads to America alone. He plans to go back to international accords the Trump administration pulled out of, like the Iran nuclear deal and the Paris Accord on climate change. And the Democrat plans to bring back and build on Obamacare, which taxes those that make the most out of health care. Trump has almost eliminated Obamacare and has cut most taxes on industry. Trump has hinted at post-results wrangling if he doesn't win, and there is talk of him declaring an early victory on election night before all the votes are even in. The atmosphere is tense, and fears of post-election violence are mounting. Guns and ammunition flew off store shelves ahead of the election. Some say they will take matters into their own hands if Donald Trump doesn't win, and minorities are buying guns as well, worried they might be prime targets. Businesses in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., are boarding up in preparation for unrest. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Race and race relations have been a central pillar of American life. But in the lead-up to this election, racial tensions have never been as critical as they are now, as Ahmed Kamalo explains in this edition of Cut to the Chase.
I'm asking for the vote of every single African-American citizen in this country. What do you have to lose? You're living in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs. 58% of your youth is unemployed. What the hell do you have to lose?
They're calling it the biggest, most significant presidential election in decades. Yet not everyone agrees. And many feel whoever is announced as the winner on November the 3rd, very little will change for the black community in the United States. The African-American human rights icon Malcolm X famously described both the Republican and the Democratic parties as racist, working against the interests of black Americans. He referred to one as the wolf and the other as a fox. No matter what, they will both beat you in the end. He made those comments in 1964, yet they still resonate with many in 2020. Everyone knows Donald Trump has made offensive comments about black people, about Muslims, about Mexicans, and has refused to condemn white supremacist militias in Charlottesville and Wisconsin. and elsewhere. Then when challenged on it, he instead endorsed a far-right neo-fascist militia group, the Proud Boys.
What do you want to call them? Give me a name. Give me a
white
name.
White supremacists and right
like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by.
And this is just since he's entered the political arena. His record goes much further than that. In 1973, Trump's management company, which he was president of at the time, was sued for operating a practice of turning away black tenants. According to an employee quoted in court documents, the staff at Trump management were directed to tell African-American lease applicants that there were no open apartments. In 1989, Trump placed full-page advertisements in four New York City newspapers, including the New York Times, calling for the state to adopt a death penalty for five black young teenagers who were wrongly accused of raping a white woman. The teenagers were coerced into confessing to a crime they did not commit without their lawyers present in a racially charged case, and their convictions were vacated in 2002. Yet Trump, to this day, has refused to apologize, and despite all the hardship the five went through and all the evidence proving their innocence, in 2019, he still implied that the five were guilty. But the problem is, because of Trump's horrendous record on race relations, his presidential opponent's own questionable record on race seems to have slipped beneath the radar, allowing the Democratic Party and the Democratic candidate to once again take the black vote for granted.
If you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, then you ain't black.
Many argue Joe Biden won the primaries because of the black vote. And if he beats Donald Trump on the 3rd of November, it will be again because of the black vote. As a recent poll shows Biden far outperforming Trump among black voters with 78% support. But if you look at his record as a senator, it makes for some disturbing reading. In 1976, he allied with racist segregationists in the south of the United States to keep black students away from the classroom of white students. But perhaps more worryingly than that was his role pushing through the controversial 1994 crime bill, which experts argue laid the groundwork for mass incarceration that has devastated America's black communities. The federal government paid states around $12 billion and incentivized them to incarcerate more people and to build more private prisons.
That 1994 crime bill, it did contribute to mass incarceration in our country.
Crucially, the way the bill was implemented was institutionally racist, leading to black Americans being imprisoned at five times the rate of whites, which devastated African American communities, leading to the current crisis where 1 in 10 black children have a parent behind bars, compared to only 1 in 60 white kids. Joe Biden was warned about the effects the crime bill would have on marginalized communities, particularly the African American community at the time. This was his response.
It doesn't matter whether or not they're the victims of society. The end result is they're about to knock my mother on the head with a lead pipe, shoot my sister, beat up my wife, take on my sons. So I don't want to ask, what made them do this? They must be taken off the street.
Furthermore, drugs commonly identified with black users like crack cocaine were sentenced at 100 times the rate of drugs associated with white users like powder cocaine, even though chemically, they were almost identical. The explosion of private prisons led to a situation where the United States, despite only having 5% of the world's population, now have 25% of the world's prisoners, with a disproportionately high percentage coming from the African American community. In fact, studies have shown the United States right now incarcerates more African Americans as a percentage than the racist apartheid state in South Africa did. So while everyone can agree Donald Trump is certainly a problem, I hope they can also realise that Joe Biden is not the answer, especially for African Americans who have suffered so much in the so-called land of the free, the United States of America.
Ahmed Caballo with that. Now to other news. Austrian police have arrested 14 people implicated in shootings that killed 4 people and injured another 22 in the capital of Vienna Monday. Authorities have identified the attacker, a 21-year-old dual national from North Macedonia, as a Daesh sympathizer. The interior minister has asked people to stay off the streets. Six locations were attacked in central Vienna Monday evening, starting outside the city's main synagogue, which was closed at the time. The victims include an elderly man, an elderly woman, a young passerby, and a waitress. Let's cross over to Vienna, where Homa Lesgi is covering that story for us. Homa, I hope you're safe. What else can you tell us?
Yes, well, we had another press conference in the afternoon by the interior minister. He keeps giving the nation more updates about what's going on. You did refer to the raids that he said were carried out, up to 18 raids, and as you said, there are 14 new arrests. And these are, we're hearing, relatives and close friends of the main attacker who was shot dead by police. This has been called now, in the words of the government, an Islamist terrorist attack. And it is causing fears here in the nation about the issue of migration, refugees, Islamist radicalization, etc. But just to give you all the latest updates, up to now, we know that there is no evidence, the Interior Minister says, that there were any further perpetrators, although they cannot also rule out that this was just an attack by a lone attacker. So that's why they're keeping security levels high, and especially in the first district where this happened, and they're advising people to stay at home and only venture outside if it's completely necessary.
Mm-hmm. Well, like you say, it is an ongoing investigation. More details will trickle out, and we'll find out about them through you later on. Let's talk about France and bring that into the conversation. They have seen similar violence in the past few weeks. However, issues of Islamophobia and racism are well documented there. Are there similar tensions in Austria?
Well, to come back to the issue that we just discussed, and that's how this is going to, you know, affect these relations between Muslims, the huge Muslim population that we have here, in Vienna and in Austria, and how it's going to affect the politics here. Well, I think that the first thing we can say is how Chancellor Sebastian Kurz attempted to address this issue, because when he made his statement to the public about this horrendous terrorist act, he said that the enemy, in his words, is extremism and terrorism. The enemy, he said, is not Muslims. He's not trying to pit Christians and Muslims against each other. He's not just saying that the enemy, he made that clear, is a member of any religious community. So I think he was trying to make it clear right now that this is just a case of extremism or terrorism. Mm. And I think this is a sign that he is trying to, you know, not go the way that the French President Emmanuel Macron has been accused of, mm-hmm. you know, of fueling tension. So at least on the face of it, the way that they're addressing this issue is that they are trying to prevent any cases of, you know, Islamophobia or attacks, further attacks, possible mm-hmm. further attacks because of Islamophobia occurring here. We already know, you said, when it comes to Islamophobia here in Austria, maybe it's not as bad as the situation we're seeing in France, but we have seen a rise of, you know, more conservative and right-wing parties here because of this fear that is here in people, mainly inherent that the refugees, that the migrants that's coming from these Muslim backgrounds are posing a threat to them. This is a rhetoric that's been put forward by the far-right groups who are active here in Austrian politics.
Right. Okay. Homa Lesgi out of Vienna for us. Homa, thank you. Moving on now. Leaders of France's Muslim community have collectively condemned attacks on French soil done in the name of Islam at a protest against cartoons depicting Prophet Muhammad.
We condemn terrorism and all forms of violence made in the name of our religion, and we express our support to all the victims of terrorism. We are calling for calm, and we encourage our youth to avoid being dragged into this path of violence and destruction.
Thousands of soldiers have been deployed to protect churches and other places of worship as tensions remain high. Emotions boiled over after French President Emmanuel Macron described Islam as a religion in crisis all over the world while defending blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet as free speech. Muslims have since protested and threatened to boycott French goods. To other news, the Director General of the World Health Organization has described the second wave of coronavirus as a decisive moment.
Over the weekend, We saw that while many countries have brought COVID-19 under control, cases in some countries in Europe and North America continue to spike. This is another critical moment for action, another critical moment for leaders to step up.
Europe is bracing for another wave of national lockdowns as cases spike and healthcare systems come under increasing pressure. Infections are rising at a faster rate than the first wave, but with fewer recorded deaths. Nigel Farage, the British politician who helped force the Brexit referendum, has announced a new political faction to fight the UK's second COVID-19 lockdown measures. The leader of the Brexit Party will rebrand his outfit as Reform UK and will challenge the government over its COVID-19 strategy, which has cost billions. The United Kingdom has the highest official COVID death toll in Europe and is grappling with more than 20,000 new coronavirus cases each day, with scientists warning of more than 80,000 dead by the end of winter. Farage, the former commodities trader, has proposed measures for the most vulnerable, while the majority continue as normal to maintain jobs and the economy. In this segment, the U.S. president's plan reportedly to declare victory before all the votes are counted. Well, let's get more on that story from Press TV's Richard Sudan. Richard, he says this is not true, but if we were to look at his record, he has denied things in the past that happened to be to the contrary and the other way around.
Well, I mean, as you rightly said, it should be stated that, of course, Donald Trump has denied the claim, which has surfaced in the form of a report doing the rounds in the U.S., that he will indeed declare victory before the magic number of 290 Electoral College votes has been reached. And I think the first thing we really need to say about this statement, let's suppose it's true for a moment, the very precarious, delicate situation in the US where we've seen over the summer tensions bubble up to boiling point. We've seen chaos on the streets, we've seen protests, people dying and being injured. So the very mention of Donald Trump potentially declaring victory before that is actually the reality. Literally, you know, could be interpreted by the bases mobilized by him in a very serious way indeed. And of course, you know, we've come used to controversial statements and controversial reports emanating from the White House, but this is quite spectacular by any means. And of course, not least because the whole electoral process this year actually quite legitimately could take a long time to really to go through in terms of counting all the votes. Obviously, there's been tens of millions of Americans that have voted by post, obviously because of the COVID-19 restrictions. Of course, there'll be tens of millions about to go to the polls. But of course, you know, if this statement's true, it's going to embolden Trump's base, no doubt about that. And this could well spill over into the streets because, of course, we've become quite used to statements made by Donald Trump being interpreted as a green light. We've not just seen it, of course, with his famous statement to the Proud Boys or interpreted to the Proud Boys, stand by, stand down. He also, you know, some would say opened up the green light towards journalists during his premiership and his presidential tenure so far. So we'll have to wait and see if indeed this actually happens. But I think, frankly, there'll be a lot of people around the world as well as in America who, frankly, won't be surprised if the president declares a victory before that's happened. And of course, if the president does get wind that the Democrats are doing well and that Joe Biden surges ahead, albeit temporarily, this may well be some kind of tactic that you could see employed. But again, you know, this potentially could make a volatile situation already much worse. We're going to see how this turns out. But in terms of the amount of engagement, the amount of Americans that are now invested in this election, record numbers turning out, the president needs to tread very carefully because any statement he makes could be interpreted in a number of ways and it could literally spill out onto the streets. We've already seen incredibly chaotic scenes over the summer, of course.
We sure have, Richard. We'll talk about that a little bit right after you bring us the tweets on this story.
Sure, some very interesting reactions online. Let's go first to the neglectful Gardner on the Twitter sphere, who says, so Trump is barricading the White House, preparing to claim victory early and challenge everything in the courts. He's a bully. Threatening is what he does best. If he loses, he will slink away like a bully as well. Of course, there have been whispers that Donald Trump is going to contest many of the votes potentially, which may come in late. And we also have a reaction here from Shredded Tweet, who says, it's going to come down to how brazenly corrupt Trump can be, and that's a lot. Expect him to declare victory early, followed by his armed minions turning up to prevent votes being counted in various states, plus him going to court, fireworks, basically. So there's, again, the potential for already an incredibly difficult process to be frustrated further by Trump's statement, if he does indeed do this.
Moving on to your second story, Trump saying that there could be violence in the streets following the election. You're looking at the images coming out of the U.S. We're looking at, for example, in Washington, how they're boarding up windows in anticipation of something like that happening. It looks very serious, Richard.
Well, again, it seems like a statement of the obvious to say there's the potential for violence. But again, Donald Trump, with his record of making potentially inflammatory statements, knows very well what he's saying. And of course, you've got the obvious armed groups, the Boogaloo Boys, the Proud Boys. But of course, there's lots of other faction of armed militia just ready to go. And some might say, Saeed, that whether or not Donald Trump wins, his base is mobilized, they're ready to go. And so we'll see how it pans out. But America's essentially on a kind of political tightrope right now. And I think a lot of how this may pan out is really going to depend on the kind of early projections that we see. But of course, there are many millions of votes to be counted, especially through the postal process. And so, you know, the wrong kind of statement here or there before
and,
this
and
process
a lot of those
is carried
votes,
out.
Richard, millions of those votes won't be counted until after Election Day. And that is where the problem lies.
Exactly. And of course, if you need a semblance of democracy, many would argue you need a president keeping a cool head, making the right kind of statements. And of course, with the very volatile situation in the U.S., if these kinds of things are to transpire, you're going to see ordinary people feeling the brunt of this. Of course, I would say that, you know, through the lens of Black America, for example, they have already been dealing with violence on the streets in the form of an increasingly militarized police force. And of course, Donald Trump not only made any statements against that, he's actually conflated, for example, right-wing militia groups and elements with the left-wing in all of its forms. So some would say Donald Trump knows very well what he's doing, and I'm afraid some people will really see this kind of statement of the obvious, the potential for violence, again, as a green light from Donald Trump. And again, you know, we're going to see in the days and weeks how this pans out. But of course, to get the actual result, we're talking potentially weeks. And so, you know, the words from the president, whatever he tweets, is going to have a very real direct impact to what's happening in the United States.
And what has the online reaction been to this, Richard?
Pretty big reaction to this story, as you'd imagine. Let's go first to a tweet from IJ, who simply says, shouldn't Donald Trump be doing all he can to stop violence? And of course, many would say his statements have been the polar opposite to bringing about a calm situation in the U.S. And we have a tweet here from Anne Connolly, who says, Trump warns of violence in the streets. Some will undoubtedly take that as an order from their leader, as Trump very well knows. And I can't really say this is the exception to the rule. I've seen so many tweets alluding to this, Saeed, basically saying Trump knows very well what he's doing. And of course, you know, his words could be interpreted in the wrong way very, very easily in what is proving to be the most controversial election in many, many years.
The most controversial election in many years, indeed. Richard Sudan with those stories. Richard, thank you. And that does it for this broadcast from London, everyone. See you soon.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Worship of Free Men. Although the promises of divine reward and punishment are all true, and his reward is very valuable and his chastisement is very painful, there are some high-minded free men who do not see anything save God and do not seek anything other than God. And the measures of their heart is full of love and kindness. Brothers and sisters, yes, there are, you know, verses in Quran and in the Ahadith of Ahlul Bayt where they have discussed the chastisement and the punishment for carrying out a misdeed or a sin. And there are also verses in Quran and the traditions of Ahlul Bayt mentioning the reward in the hereafter in the form and shape of Jannah and heaven and, you know, paradise for a believer and those who do good act and so on and so forth. These things are in their own place of importance. But there are some people who worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala because they love Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because they just don't see anybody else being worthy of being worshipped. They're looking beyond rewards and punishment. Their motive of observing God's command is only love mingled with his cognition and knowing. So their ma'rifat compels them to obey Allah and to worship Allah and to pray to Allah. And this is something very special. This is the worship of a free man, and we're going to bring to you a hadith after the break, which is going to make it even more clear for you what we're trying to say here. Welcome back, dear listeners. We're talking about, you know, the concept of reward and punishment and all of those things being very legit. But there are some people who observe Islam. They submit to Islam. They submit to Allah. They worship Allah. Why? Not out of fear, not out of temptation, no fear of hell, no temptation of paradise. Rather, their worship is because they love Allah. They recognize Allah. Their in-depth recognition, ma'rifat, it creates this feeling inside them to worship Allah and submit to Allah. Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, the sixth infallible Imam, has said, worshippers fall into three groups. Those who worship Allah for the fear of hell. This is the worship of slaves. Then the second is those who worship Allah for his reward. This is the worship of mercenaries or traders. The third one is those who worship Allah out of love and affection for him. This is the worship of free men. Brothers and sisters, it's essential for us to strive and struggle to become one of those free men and women, those free beings who worship Allah for who Allah is, who have so much in-depth recognition of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that they feel compelled to worship Him. It is still good to keep worshipping out of the fear of hell and the temptation of paradise, there's, you know, so to speak, nothing wrong with it. You know, it's a beginner's level, right? But really, that ideal state that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants us to see in is the worship of a free man. This is what we are expected to achieve. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Chinese documents show that U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross did not successfully step down from all of his corporate commitments. Wilbur Ross, an investor turned U.S. Commerce Secretary, has long been accused of ethical violations because of his failure to extricate himself from his business ties. Documents obtained by Foreign Policy magazine show that Wilbur Ross's potential conflicts of interest around Chinese businesses are greater than previously known. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Isaac Stone Fish and has been taken from the Foreign Policy magazine. The piece is titled, Wilbur Ross Remained on Chinese Joint Venture Board Whilst Running U.S.-China Trade War. Stay with us for more of Isaac Stone Fish's article. Chinese documents show that the U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross did not successfully step down from all of his corporate commitments. Wilbur Ross, an investor turned U.S. Commerce Secretary, has long been accused of ethical violations because of his failure to extricate himself from his business ties. Documents obtained by Foreign Policy magazine show that Ross's potential conflicts of interest around Chinese businesses are greater than previously known. In Chinese corporate documents obtained by Foreign Policy magazine, Wilbur Ross is listed as serving on the board of a Chinese joint venture until January of 2019, nearly 2 years into his term as U.S. Commerce Secretary. That joint venture, now called Huaneng Invesco WLR Beijing Investment Fund Management Co., is an investment partnership formed in September of 2008 between Huaneng Capital Services, the U.S. management company Invesco, and the firm Wilbur Ross founded, W.L. Ross & Co. Huaneng Capital Services is an arm of China Huaneng Group, a major state-owned power producer in China. The documents correspond to the information found on Chinese corporate data sites, such as Qichacha and Qixinbao, including the date of board membership. The documents don't say if Wilbur Ross was paid for his board seat or whether there is any current financial relationship between Ross and the joint venture. It's also unclear if Wilbur Ross knew that he remained on the board seat. The more recent documents don't include the signatures or seals of the individual board members. That Chinese documents state Wilbur Ross was on the board of a Chinese joint venture until January of 2019 has not been previously reported. The US-China trade war started heating up in the summer of 2018, as Beijing and Washington levied increasingly onerous tariffs on each other. At the same time as Wilbur Ross was overseeing the trade war as US Commerce Secretary, he was still, according to paperwork, on the board of a joint venture that was a partnership with a Chinese state-owned firm. Instead of reporting on well-documented facts, including a dated and signed letter of resignation that I provided them, Foreign Policy magazine is purporting a false narrative that I remained on the board of a Chinese company, citing Chinese documents, Wilbur Ross replied in a statement sent by U.S. Commerce Department. It is clear which Foreign Policy magazine actually support, and the American public deserves better. The letter that Wilbur Ross provided to Foreign Policy magazine is dated 27th of February 2017, marked confidential, and has as its subject line, regarding resignation from WLR entities. In the letter addressed to W.L. Ross & Co., Wilbur Ross writes that he shall be deemed to have retired, resigned, or withdrawn from every entity affiliated with W.L. Ross & Co. Wilbur Ross lists dozens of companies that he claims the letter applies to, including those affiliated with Huaneng. But Chinese corporate law experts, consulted by Foreign Policy magazine, say that under Chinese law, writing a private letter to a U.S. parent company does not remove one from Chinese corporate boards. The failure to withdraw from the board may have just been an inadvertent slip, but what you said is clearly not a false narrative, said Fred Rockefort, an attorney at the international law firm Harris Bricken. Chinese corporate records establish without a doubt that Wilbur Ross was officially on the board until 1st of February 2019. Wilbur Ross's position as U.S. Commerce Secretary allowed him to influence the direction of the U.S.-China trade war that America's global trade policies. Whilst there is no evidence that Ross directly benefited from the joint venture while serving as Commerce Secretary, entanglements like this have traditionally been seen as potential violations of the national interest. Public trust demands that all employees act in public's interest and are free from any actual or perceived conflict of interest when fulfilling governmental responsibilities entrusted to them. The then acting director of the U.S. Office of Government Ethics wrote to Wilbur Ross in a July 2018 letter about other inadvertent ethical violations. On 20th of March 2017, less than a month after Wilbur Ross was confirmed as U.S. Commerce Secretary, the joint venture entered into a partnership with a parent company, Huaneng, and Taikang Asset Management Company, a subsidiary of the major Chinese insurance firm Taikang. The companies agreed to raise about $745 million to invest in renewable energy projects, a market that Wilbur Ross had influence over at the U.S. Commerce Department and which was directly affected by trade tariffs. Ross's relationship to the Taikang partnership has not been previously reported. One set of documents that Foreign Policy magazine obtained, dated March 2018, showed that the joint venture filed paperwork stating which of its previous board members would continue to serve on the board. Wilbur Ross's name is on that list. Another document from January of 2019 removes Ross from the board and appoints the investor Nadim Qureshi as a new board member. Qureshi served on the board until September of 2020. The joint venture affixed its seal to the document. Under Chinese law, a seal is generally seen as more official than a signature. Wilbur Ross attended a board meeting in September of 2012 and signed an agreement with other directors to, among other changes, increase the company's registered capital to about $25 million and its total investment to $76 million, and to change the name of the joint venture from Huaneng Investco WLR Investment Consulting Co. to its current name. Long bullish about investing in China, Wilbur Ross and his firm WL Ross & Co., along with Invesco, formed the joint venture to tap into private equity investments in power generation in China, the firm said in a 2008 press release. Back in 2000, Wilbur Ross founded the private equity firm WL Ross & Co., which focused on distressed assets. He sold the firm to the money manager Ambescap, now Invesco, in 2006. Wilbur Ross continued to serve as the chief executive officer of Invesco's private equity group until joining the government in February of 2017. But Ross only sold his shares in Invesco in December of 2017, nearly a year into his tenure as the U.S. Commerce Secretary. He was supposed to sell his shares valued between $10 million and $50 million before the end of May of 2017. But the non-profit Center for Public Integrity found that because Invesco's stock rose in the meantime, the delay netted Wilbur Ross between $1.2 million and $6 million. I discovered that the previously held stock had not been sold. I then promptly sold these shares, Wilbur Ross later wrote in a disclosure. Wilbur Ross has been repeatedly warned about ethics violations. In his December 2016 ethics disclosure form, Wilbur Ross disclosed that he was on the board of Huaneng Joint Venture from 2008 until present. In March 2018, the non-profit liberal advocacy group Public Citizen released a report titled Follow the Money. Did administration officials' financial entanglements with China delay Trump's promised tough on China trade policy? The report discusses many of Wilbur Ross's alleged conflict of interest with China, including his relationship with Diamond S Shipping, a Connecticut-headquartered firm that at the time was partially owned by the Chinese government. The report also mentions Ross's relationship with Huaneng. In a September 2019 interview with the Washington Post, Wilbur Ross denied ever having any conflict of interest whilst in office. In July of 2018, the Office of Government Ethics wrote a scathing public letter to Wilbur Ross, criticizing him for various omissions and inaccurate statements in his disclosure forms and compliance documents. Even inadvertent errors regarding compliance with your ethical obligations can undermine public trust in both you and the overall ethics program, the letter stated. In response, Wilbur Ross filed an extensive annual financial disclosure report for that year. In February of 2019, the director of the Office of Government Ethics refused to certify the report because Wilbur Ross didn't sell all of his shares in the Florida-based bank, BankUnited. But there was another possible error in Ross's 2018 financial disclosure report. In that report, Ross claims that he had left the Huaneng joint venture in February of 2017, but according to Chinese law, he was still a director of the joint venture until 1st of February 2019. This error, however, inadvertent on Ross's financial disclosure report, has not been previously reported.
A new stab in the back. That's how the Palestinians described the agreement between Sudan's transitional government and Israel. Sudan and Israel have agreed to normalize ties. Sudan followed suit after Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates normalized ties with Israel earlier this year. The United States brokered the agreement between the two parties, making Sudan the fifth Arab country to establish relations with Israel. The deal was sealed apparently in a phone call with US President Donald Trump, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, and Transitional Council head Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The leaders agreed to the normalization of relations between Sudan and Israel and to end the state of belligerence between their nations, said the joint statement by the United States, Israel, and Sudan. An official signing ceremony is expected to be held at the White House in the weeks to come. Israel and Sudan agreed to normalize relations in conjunction with U.S. President Donald Trump signing a decree removing Sudan from the list of countries sponsoring terrorism. Sudan has for years had financial troubles, and after former President Omar al-Bashir was ousted in a popular uprising against him, the transitional government thought the U.S. would finally take the country off its blacklist. But it has been reported that Sudan was under pressure by the US, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia to normalize with Israel if it wants to alleviate its financial burdens. Finally, Sudan normalizes ties with Israel only 2 weeks after the US took it off its blacklist. But seeing that this is what the country had to do to achieve what seems like financial freedom, many people in Sudan are not happy about this. Sudanese protesters have taken to the streets to condemn the current government's decision to forge diplomatic relations with Israel. Sudan's National Ummah Party, NUP, the largest political party there, rejected any normalization with Israel. The NUP's leader, Sadiq al-Mahdi, said the transitional government, which is to remain in office until elections in 2022, has no mandate to make decisions on such controversial issues. The NUP's leader, Sadiq al-Mahdi, withdrew from a government-organized religious conference in protest against the normalization announcement. He said, "This statement contradicts the deal, the Sudanese national law, and contributes to the elimination of the peace project in the Middle East and to preparing for the ignition of a new war." Sadiq al-Mahdi carries huge political and popular weight as he was the Prime Minister of Sudan three times and also known as the country's last elected premier. Other Sudanese political parties also lined up to declare their rejection of the normalization agreement, stressing they are going to form a front to oppose the move. the Sudanese Ba'ath Party, the Sudanese Communist Party, National Consensus Forces NCF, a coalition of political parties, the National Democratic Alliance NDA, the Forces of Freedom and Change FFC Alliance, the Popular Congress Party, as well as Sudan Change Now Political Movement, stated that they are fiercely against any relationship between Khartoum and Tel Aviv. Sudan has been tense for a while after a popular uprising last year led the military to overthrow the longtime autocrat Omar al-Bashir. The transitional government has promised elections as soon as 2022. Al-Mahdi, who heads the National Ummah Party, was overthrown in a 1989 coup that brought al-Bashir to power. His party is allied with the movement that led to protests against al-Bashir. The normalization announcement by Sudan came as a surprise to many, as the African country has long been a supporter of the Palestinians and their cause. In 1948, a detachment of troops from Sudan were among the Arab armies Israel fought against when it was incepted onto Palestinian lands. When Sudan gained independence in 1956 from British rule, Israel secretly aided separatist rebels in southern Sudan. Sudan sent a contingent of troops to aid Egyptian forces in the 1967 war with Israel. Sudan hosted a landmark Arab League conference on August 29, 1967. That day, eight Arab countries approved the Khartoum Resolution, known as the Three No's Resolution: no peace with Israel, no recognition of Israel, and no negotiations with Israel. In the 1970s, Israeli pilots operating from Uganda and Kenya flew arms to the rebel forces of southern Sudan once again. Fast forward to the years leading up to the 2011 independence of South Sudan from Sudan, and even decades before that, Israeli military officials were meeting with rebels in Israel. In secret, visits to Israel, southern Sudanese rebels received financial and military aid from Tel Aviv. It is no wonder that Israel was one of the first to recognize South Sudan after its independence. Israel recognized South Sudan on July 10, 2011, a day after South Sudan became an independent state. On July 15th of that year, South Sudan announced that it intended to have full diplomatic relations with Israel. On July 28th, 2011, Israel announced that it had established full diplomatic ties with South Sudan. Sudan's agreement to normalize with Israel seems to be built upon political pressure that has divided the country and created political tension and turmoil for decades. It is also clear that U.S. President Donald Trump is the entity enforcing the controversial normalization deals. This leaves one wondering, will normalization with Israel hold after the U.S. election on November 3, or is Trump sowing the seeds of further destabilization in a country and region that has witnessed far too much of it?
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.